This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. On Wednesday, the State Department of Agriculture is partnering with several groups to hold an all-day workshop on agritourism. The educational event is pegged to an outbreak of E. coli in eastern Connecticut earlier this year. Here in Connecticut, we love our local farms, but we wanted to find out more about the growth in agritourism, as well as why the state's urging farmers and visitors to take certain precautions. Joining us by phone now is Dr. Bruce Sherman. He's a veterinarian and director of the Bureau of Inspection and Regulation at the Connecticut Department of Agriculture. Dr. Sherman, welcome to Where We Live.
Well, thank you for inviting me to be on your show.
So you have an all-day, a workshop of sorts tomorrow at the Legislative Office Building. Tell us about what prompted this this forum on agritourism.
Well, what prompted it is the outbreak that you referred to, where there were people that became ill from contact with goats on a farm in eastern Connecticut. And that outbreak resulted in about maybe around 50 people becoming ill from E. coli 0157. And that included two or three cases of children that had hemolytic uremic syndrome and had to be on dialysis. So as a result of that and some previous outbreaks in earlier years, not all related to direct contact with animals, but some related to animal products that weren't cooked or pasteurized, we felt that we needed to conduct some outreach, not only for farmers or producers, but also for the public to make them more aware of the risks involved when farms open up their, or owners of farms open up their farms to visitors when they conduct open houses or just have visitors, and people either have direct contact with animals or consume food at the farm, or animal products that are produced at the farm.
And Dr. Sherman, so how did the there's a lot of people that got sick from that exposure at that farm in eastern Connecticut. How did that happen? Was it were they petting the goats, or can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, it was direct contact with the goats. They were petting the goats. They were intimately in the environment with the goats. It was during kidding season, so some of the children that attended the event actually sat in some of the kid pens, kid meaning young goats, not children. So the children held the kids and had direct contact with them, as did some of the adults. And the then it's usually transmitted from a hand-to-mouth oral route when people become infected. And the organism wasn't only isolated from the goats themselves, but also in the environment. So with people just having contact with the environment, for example, if they put their hand on a gate or something that might be contaminated with the E. coli, that could be a source of infection too.
It seems, I'm curious how much agritourism has grown in Connecticut, and because of that, you know, what are some precautions that local farms should take? Obviously, it's a good thing when visitors want to come and support their local farms, but there are some precautions that need to happen.
Well, yes, and that's one of the purposes of this meeting, is to not only address the risks, but to address the measures that farms can take to mitigate the risk. And they need to make visitors aware that there is a risk. They need to have do a better job at putting up signage, limiting where visitors go on the farms, and limiting contact with the animals to a certain extent, and make sure that they have hand-washing facilities and instructions on how people should properly wash their hands after they've had direct contact with animals.
This is Where We Live. We're talking about agritourism. Are you a farmer with livestock who holds events to encourage visitors to your farm? You can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, wmpr.org/where we live, or you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. I wanted to bring into the conversation Diane Wright Hirsch, a food safety educator with the Yukon Extension. You're also one of the speakers at this agritourism panel tomorrow. So welcome to Where We Live.
Good morning. Thank you.
So your wheelhouse is food safety. So we were talking with Dr. Sherman about precautions that need to happen when people are in contact with livestock. But how do you educate local farmers about keeping their products safe and making sure that their things aren't being transmitted when they're sold to the public?
I think one of the biggest sort of differences in today's agritourism or in farming in general is when you're bringing people onto the farm or you're serving them food, is to sort of take off that farmer hat and put on that food processor hat or food maker hat, because I think they've worked in a situation where the barn is where they do things and they're not used to the need for, let's say, a hand washing sink or stainless steel surfaces for best cleaning, you know, not thinking about the cleanability of their facility. So we really kind of have to start from scratch and get them to understand sort of the interface between the farm environment and the food preparation environment and what are the risks, as well as how to mitigate them, starting usually with trying to find out who their local food regulator is and making really good friends with them.
So we heard about the E. coli outbreak from this farm in eastern Connecticut where there was livestock. But if a farm doesn't have particular animals, what are some risks that that could be there on their produce that they're also growing and selling?
Excellent question. Well, even though there may not be domesticated animals on the farm, there certainly is the risk of a variety of wildlife. Deer can carry E. coli. Rodents, flies, if you're contiguous to a farm that may have manure on the premises, then that could be an issue. Or even if you use manure on your produce farm, the risk of cross-contamination of that into a food venue exists.
So you work at Yukon Extension. For people who are unfamiliar with that, tell us about the mission and how you work with farmers.
Okay, Extension started back in the early 1900s as a USDA program to actually bring research-based information to the farmer. So we basically had three areas that we worked in. We worked with the farmers themselves. We worked with farm families with what was called a home demonstration agent at that time. And then finally, we worked with the kids with the 4-H program. And over the years, obviously, as our agriculture businesses have changed, particularly in the Northeast, we have brought on other audiences. But we still like to reach our original targeted audience through a variety of programs with nutrition, production information, animal health information, et cetera.
Is this something, this workshop tomorrow on agritourism and protecting the health of farmers or livestock and the public, is that something that local farmers are asking for? They want to hear this kind of information at an event like this?
Well, do they want to hear it or should they hear it? I think particularly in the area of food safety, it's something that, you know, really in terms of produce safety, we've been trying to preach since 1998 when the first guidelines came out. And, you know, like anything new, it's hard to bring people along because there will be, you know, knowledge to gain. There will be expenses to make, and it will make some changes in the way that they do business. But usually, ultimately, once they understand the risks that are presented by either their product or their operation and learn that there are things that they can do that won't necessarily break the bank, they do tend to come around. I actually have quite a few champions at this point in time.
We have a farmer in studio with us, Sven Peel, lead designer and owner of Connecticut Edible Ecosystems, also farm and grounds manager at Knox Incorporated in Hartford. Welcome to Where We Live, Sven.
Thank you. Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So I wanted to throw that question to you. How much do farmers want the state to help them educate themselves about, you know,
proper regulations and inspections and what they should be doing to protect the, you know, the safety of their livestock as well as the public.
I have to agree with Diane that I'm sure it's a mixed bag. There are some that have been doing the same thing for a long time and do not like change. And then currently there's quite a few more young people that would probably relish this sort of information so they can design their farms around the protocols that Diane works on.
And I want to turn back to Dr. Bruce Sherman again, a veterinarian, also a speaker at tomorrow's event about agritourism. Dr. Sherman, I see on the rundown that the CDC is also part of this forum. Can you talk about issues from the national level and how that trickles down to help local farmers here in Connecticut?
Well, that's correct. We are fortunate to have a speaker, Dr. Megan Nichols from CDC, with us tomorrow. And CDC was involved in the investigation at the goat farm where the E. coli outbreak was, to which the E. coli outbreak was traced. And she has agreed to be a presenter tomorrow. And so she's going to give an overview of some of the more notable outbreaks that have occurred traced to farms on a national basis, so that she'll create sort of a foundation to show what the incidents can be and what the impact can be. And then in the afternoon, she'll be going over some of the measures that farmers can take to mitigate their risks.
And as far as that farm in eastern Connecticut where we had that E. coli outbreak earlier this year, are they still in operation?
No, they're not. They're no longer in operation at this point. They may come back into business, but right now they are not.
Is that something that was their decision or because of how the farm was operated that this was something that the state stepped in?
No, that was their decision. One thing that people should understand is that livestock, no matter what species, is a reservoir for E. coli and can shed E. coli at any time. Under certain circumstances, there may be more animals in a herd that are shedding at one time, or even individual animals shedding more organisms, depending on certain factors. So it's always a risk. But that's the thing that we have to make people aware of, whether it's farmers or the public.
I want to thank Dr. Bruce Sherman, veterinarian and director of the Bureau of Inspection and Regulation at the Connecticut Department of Agriculture. Also, Diane Wright Hirsch, who's a food safety educator with the UConn Extension. Both will be speaking at a workshop on agritourism at the Legislative Office Building in Hartford tomorrow from 9 to 3. We'll have more information on our website at wmpr.org/where we live. Coming up, we'll talk more about the state of agriculture in Connecticut. Are you a farmer? What made you interested in growing food and raising livestock in your community? You can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchel. It's late summer, and that means farmers markets and your weekly CSA share is becoming more bountiful. Today, we're looking at whether farming is growing in Connecticut, and we've invited some local farmers to explain what led them to work the land in a time when most of us still depend on grocery stores for our food. In studio with us again is Sven Peel, lead designer and owner of Connecticut Edible Ecosystems and the farm and grounds manager at Knox Incorporated in Hartford. And joining us now is Henry Talmadge, executive director of the Connecticut Farm Bureau Association. Welcome to Where We Live.
Hi, good morning.
And also Susan Collins, and I have your information here, owner and operator at Clover Lee Farms in Mansfield. Is that right?
It is. It's Susan Mitchell.
Susan Mitchell. Susan Mitchell. Thank you, Susan, for coming on Where We Live. So I guess I'll start with you, Susan. Tell me about your farm.
I have a small-scale diversified organic vegetable farm. And I utilize a very old dairy farm, which is no longer milking any cows, and so I'm kind of giving new life to it as a vegetable producer.
And what led you to want to be a farmer? I read in a bio that it wasn't something that you had started your career.
Absolutely not. I grew up in the suburbs of New York City, so there were no farms where I lived. And like a lot of fellow farmers my age, you know, we're not from farm families, didn't grow up in rural areas. And I started growing food with kids when I was a high school science teacher in New York State. And I lived in the Hudson Valley where there were a lot of small-scale organic farms and knew some farmers and started volunteering and then started working, left my job as a teacher, and started into agriculture.
And how's that journey been so far?
It's been pretty crazy. It's been
a lot of work.
Yes. It's been really fun and very rewarding.
Also in studio with me again is Sven Peel. I understand that you farmed in several different states. So what brought you to the farm?
The crash of 2008. I was trying to figure out how to care for myself after being laid off. And pretty much one of the things I needed was food. So I looked into several programs. WIA, the Federal Workforce Investment Act, was one of them. And Connecticut didn't seem to support one, learning how to take care of themselves. So considering there were no jobs, I generally used my unemployment compensation as a stipend to teach myself how to grow and moved forward from there.
And how's that journey been for you? Obviously, you had to start from scratch and learn a lot.
Well, I grew up with gardens in the yard, but that's very different than trying to produce for yourself, working with community and children and so on. It is bumpy. The support structures are seemingly light at times. I'm appreciative of Susan's work. That's definitely helping those that are trying to do the same thing and the other entities in Connecticut as well.
And you mentioned Susan. She's also a steering committee member for the New Connecticut Farming Alliance, so
yes,
a support network for farmers.
Yes.
Tell us about that, Susan, why you felt the need to be part of an organization like that.
When I had moved to Connecticut, I didn't know anyone. I moved here for a job at a farm. And with a couple other farmers, we decided we needed to sort of coalesce other young, new, and beginning small-scale farmers just to really create a better sense of community and get to know each other. And so we created the New Connecticut Farmer Alliance for that purpose. And it has very slowly and organically grown over the last 5 years. And we put on a lot of social events so that farmers can really, like, get together and talk shop and drink a beer, you know, and really just develop a culture around agriculture. The small-scale farms that are marketing direct-to-consumer and through CSAs, they're spread out a little bit in this state. So it's nice to be able to try to get people together to feel like there are other people doing what they're doing.
Let's talk more about the farming community. I had mentioned Henry Talmadge is here, executive director of the Connecticut Farm Bureau Association. What does the landscape look like in terms of how many farms are here in Connecticut, Henry?
Well, first of all, the landscape of agriculture is constantly changing and has been since beginning of time. So that one thing to embrace is change. So there are, according to USDA, just under 6,000 farm units in the state. Their definition is a farm that produces or is capable of selling $1,000 worth of gross sales of ag products. So that number is up from in the 2012 census compared to 2007 by almost 1,000 units. So that's fantastic news in that the number of people engaged in agriculture, like Susan and Sven, is increasing, or at least has increased. During the same time period, the actual farm gate sales, which is the economic activity of the wholesale product sold, is about level at about 600 million. So there are more people producing about the same number. Agriculture in the state of Connecticut is defined pretty broadly. It includes the ornamental greenhouse and nursery crops, horses, aquaculture, fruits and vegetables, obviously, and tobacco and other things. So it's a broad category. So we're seeing a growth in fruits and vegetables, although each are about 7% of the total of the farm gate sales. Still, almost half of it is in the ornamental green industry, so to give you an idea. And actually, tobacco which is leaf wrapper tobacco, is actually still larger than both fruits and vegetables individually in the state. It's a big surprise to folks. So there's a lot of change going on. There's a lot of new people engaged in agriculture, and there is a general trend towards the interest in local agriculture moving closer to consumers with our agricultural products, and that feeds into agritourism.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalbathanchel. We're talking about tourism in Connecticut, this idea of more farms in the state and inviting people onto the farm, eliminating that middleman to get acquainted with the local farmer. If you're one of those farmers, give us a call, 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. You know, Henry, I wanted to ask you something about a follow-up from what Sven had said about there not being a lot of support when you're looking to get into farming here in Connecticut. What are some programs that exist to help people who want to become farmers? And what are some places that the state could strengthen in terms of that support?
Well, so one of the challenges with a very diverse and increasingly diverse balance of agriculture is that there are many, many people looking to do different things as opposed to, you know, commodity production of agriculture. If you're growing, you know, corn in Iowa, all the corn farmers have the same challenges, and it makes it more efficient to distribute information and help to them as producers. So our model is fragmented. That being said, Diane Hirsch here from the University of Connecticut UConn program, there are some programs within UConn. The Jeff Martin runs a sustainable agricultural program. Joseph Benelli does support for economic and business plan writing, as well as the Farm Credit System, which has people to help. Groups like Farm Bureau and the Farmers Alliance and all have programs to help people as much as possible. So there are resources, and of course the world of online resources is huge, but. But what we see are each of these farms are individual in terms of what their specific needs are and challenges of getting information directly to them. It's not a real efficient way to do it. But
so a lot of independent small farms in the state of Connecticut. Sven, you were hearing what Henry had said about some of the programs that exist. What would have helped you when you look back at, you know, your foray into farming?
With what I've learned today, I can look at that from two different directions. But I would say, you know, an introduction to soils and soil health is probably one of the most important aspects of food production. That also increases the nutritional value of food. And so something programmatic in that realm that progresses through a plant's life to its sales and consumption, as well as the business aspects that are connected to that, and then the culture of the area that you're working in. Because even depending on where you are in Connecticut, there's different cultures. I work on an urban farm, which is very different than where I live in Guilford, which is a little bit more rural. And what are the needs of the populace that you reside in? I guess I kind of answered that question all in one.
And Susan, when you went into agriculture, again, you're part of this new Connecticut Farming Alliance, but your property is not very big. So how are you efficient in what you're producing and selling in your CSAs?
Well, I think just to go back to for a minute as to how to learn about farming, like a lot of careers that are very hands-on, you learn through apprenticing. You work on a farm for others who know what they're doing. You do that for a couple years. It would be you'd be hard-pressed to just like jump in and say, I'm going to start a farm and not know anything about it. So you really need to take the time to learn, which is what I've done, a lot of others have done, sort of slowly moved up through the ranks. And in that time, attended a lot of conferences, go to a lot of workshops, do a lot of reading, and gain that knowledge, because it takes a lifetime to learn what you need to know how to farm. You know, I've only grown potatoes 8 times in my life because it's a one-season crop. You know, that's not a lot. So my farm in particular is very diversified. I grow, you know, over 40 different types of crops. And so it is challenging in that right. And every year is a little different. Some things do really well, some things don't. And that's part of farming. You know, it can be a little hit or miss. There's a lot of things that are out of our control, like the weather or insect, you know, explosions or molds or whatever it might be. And so you learn to just roll with it and do the best you can.
You mentioned the weather. We've had a lot of, it seems, more dry summers in the last few years. How does that impact your success as a small farm?
Mm-hmm. It can be hugely detrimental if you are a vegetable grower or animals and you don't have access to sufficient water. For vegetables in particular, I mean, and or hay, corn, anyone that doesn't irrigate crops, and that's really tough. Thankfully, as someone utilizing an older farm property, I have irrigation ponds that I'm able to use. So thank goodness. Otherwise, I would have a whole head of gray hair because I'd be so stressed about the fact that we've had so little rainfall during certain stretches. So having the right infrastructure on your farm becomes key in vegetable production. And I think we've seen, probably Henry, you can comment on this, some decreases in corn yields and hay yields because of lack of water.
Yeah, that's exactly true, and it's localized because the nature of kind of summer thunderstorms and rain patterns can actually give relief to a field on one side of the road, and the other side of the crop is dead. So it's really complex. I think irrigation, as we look at fruits and vegetables, is a key component, not only because of what Susan just described in terms of the ability to manage moisture as much as anything else, but it also has a food safety component to it because as Diane Hirsch, who was in your previous segment, knows from the Food Safety Modernization Act, the actual use of irrigation technology, meaning drip irrigation in particular, will make it easier to comply with food safety regulations as it's moving forward, which is a dynamic that has a regulatory umbrella that covers it. But that those are capital intensive items that have to have a payback. And, you know, it points to the issue of, you know, we spend a lot of time talking about sustainability in agriculture. Economic sustainability is such a critical component to that, and so that's all enters into this discussion about local agriculture and how it's going to fare.
And what is the economic impact of all of these smaller farms in Connecticut? Obviously, we're not Iowa or Kansas, where you have these giant farms that go on for a long ways.
Well, it's really interesting because analyzing the statistics and the data on this, you have to be careful about what it means. As I mentioned, the kind of the 6,000 farm units, 56% of those 6,000 farm units gross less than $1,500 a year in the state. So that means there's a lot of very small farms. And if you add that up, if you said, well, that's not a lot of economic activity from a big portion of the number of farmers. And if you stopped there, you'd miss a lot of the story. For one, those folks are providing a pathway to local food that has a multiplier effect in the economy. But they also are farming land that helps preserve and protect the rural landscape, provides wildlife habitat and a whole host of other benefits that you have to be careful in analyzing and putting a number on. I mean, the agricultural segment's about $3.5 billion to Connecticut's economy, and it's roughly 28,000 jobs associated with agriculture, including the distribution and kind of infrastructure and processing. So it's a big piece of the economy. But I think when we look at the benefits of agriculture, we have to look at all of the benefits to the state and what it means to the residents.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. We're talking about the state of farming here in Connecticut. If you have a question or comment, 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. I want to take a call now. Laura from Meriden. Laura, you're on Where We Live.
Hi. I'm going on my first volunteer experience to an organic farm up in Maine through the Wolf program. I'm not sure if your guests are familiar with it.
I think they're nodding, so go ahead, Laura.
Okay, so Wolf is a volunteer program where farms sign up and volunteers sign up, and you get matched up to a farm. You get to actually pick which farm you'd like to go to, and it's a worldwide organization of organic farms. And so I'm looking forward to that. I tried planting a garden, didn't get anything this year. So I decided to go learn by joining that program and working on an organic farm.
All right, Laura, thank you for your comment. So I know, Susan, you had mentioned earlier to learn about farming, it's important to apprentice and get experience on the local farm. And so she's taking that a step by going up to Maine to learn.
Mm-hmm. Which is great. Wolfing is certainly popular, often among young people who can travel maybe after college or during the summer and get a little taste of it. It is very different, however, than employment on a farm. Woofers usually work just in exchange for room and board and stay for short periods of time. So for people that are farming for a business, they more often than not do not use woofers because it's not a efficient way in many instances to run a production farm.
You know, we often hear about young people that are returning to the land who want to be farmers. But, you know, what needs to happen to get them more interested? We're hearing anecdotally that that's happening. But, Sven, do you want to take that question of what are some programs that could exist today to help more people be interested in farming?
That's a tough one. I mean, I think the best bet is to just feel out the area and see who is doing what regarding organizations or individuals and take that route. I think a big question tied to that is why are people leaving their positions to either purchase or work on a farm? We are seeing that out of, let's say Westchester County in New York City, people buying land in Litchfield and in northern Fairfield counties. And that's a different type of person than a young person that's taking time off from school or after school and looking to grow their or connect with the agricultural movement.
We know that land is expensive, so how do they get that? How do they get into that if they don't have the cash?
Maybe you can tell me,
Henry. Do you wanna take that?
Well, you know, land access is one issue that is a barrier to entry, especially by young farmers interested in getting involved in agriculture. Susan certainly has done a lot of work on this and experienced some of those challenges, so she could speak to it. I will say, from my perspective, there is a lot of interest in agriculture, both in young people and people who want to come to a farm as a second career and all that. It's really very interesting and very exciting. Going back to this, the economic piece of it, the economics of local agriculture have to be improved in order for those folks to be successful. And being financially successful will grow the industry in a way that that there's plenty of folks who will step up and do that if they're able to financially. So I think what we have to think about with local agriculture, sustainable agriculture, all Connecticut-based agriculture is about focusing on the economic potential and improve the economic situation of agriculture. That's what will be that will be the ultimate success of local agriculture.
And Susan's nodding her head from Cloverly Farms. Talk about that, about, you know, trying to find a way to be successful.
It is incredibly difficult to make a livelihood as a farmer, regardless of what you're growing or raising. Small-scale farms are very, very tough. and let alone trying to buy a house or send your kids through college or save for retirement. The financial side of things is critical. And what I think we've seen all these small farms pop up. We've had an explosion of sorts in nationwide, the number of people who are interested in farming. We've seen a rise in the number of farms in Connecticut, but we're still marketing to the same crowd. So now we have more farmers in production producing more products and the same number of people buying it. So the marketing has not risen along with farm growth. And so the marketplace within even the past 5 years for local food has changed dramatically. And everyone is on the local bandwagon from McDonald's to Subway to you name it. Someone in marketing has decided that people want local food. Really, most people don't. Most people buy their food at the grocery store. I mean, if we can be perfectly honest about it, the number of people that shop at farmers markets at CSAs and buy directly from the farmer or go to farm stands is minuscule. So I think and I think about this a lot as I try to support myself through farming because this is my career. I don't do anything else. And if the economics don't improve, like I will not be in business. It's the same, same true for any small business owner. I happen to grow food and sell it. That's my commodity. But for anyone, if you can't make a living at it, that's it. You're gonna close shop. So I think the marketing side of actually either getting more people to come out to the farmers markets, because we have so many farmers markets in the state, a lot of them are really poor, poorly attended. The farmers hardly take anything home. So that's clearly not working. Mm-hmm. Grocery stores do buy some local products. Sometimes it looks pretty crummy on the shelves, and I've taken photos of it and emailed it to people and said, why would anyone want to buy local when it looks like this? But if you attend a farmer's market or a CSA or a farm stand, you see how beautiful that produce is. You know the cost is honestly no higher than what you're often buying at the grocery store. There's this lure that – or this idea that local produce is, or vegetables or meat is more expensive. In some cases, it is, and it's an economy of scale issue for sure. But if we want to maintain rural character, if we want to keep open spaces, if we want to have agriculture as part of our state, people need to buy it.
Sven, you wanted to add something?
I just returned from upstate New York for a land planning course, and in that we were designing a 50-acre apple cider and cider pear site connected to the ponds and irrigation ponds. That was part of the land planning course. And that we can definitely take that into account to our climate, as well as what we're seeing down south right now regarding these 500-year events where basically everything's underwater. So the planning aspect of that I think is incredibly important for beginning farmers to understand the geography of their landscape, how to retain water, how to shed water when necessary. connected to that was we visited a brewery as part of that course. And the gentlemen who were there, they just graduated UVM. And in New York, I don't understand the policy exactly, but they mandate that 20% of the products are locally grown. That's what these gentlemen were telling me. And so in that, I was thinking with the land planning aspect of this farm that we were designing, between these rows of fruit trees, we could grow grains for the beer, for the brewery, or grow hops. Hops are a little difficult to grow considering our humidity here. So that particular farmer was actually interested in growing grains between her apple trees. So now you're connecting a farm in a locale to a brewery just down the road, and you end up creating these closed-loop systems. And I think that's something that we need to look at in Connecticut as well. And that includes strengthening the mandates of what we call locally grown.
I want to take a quick call. Mia from Mansfield, you're on Where We Live, Mia.
Hi. Thanks so much for taking my call. I'm actually calling because I'm a new bed and breakfast owner here in Mansfield, and I've been part of a CSA that's local. However, one of your earlier callers was talking about really gaining experience in agriculture through actually working with and apprenticing with someone, which I've found to be really tough. I've had no problem finding someone that I could actually purchase a CSA share from, but to actually find one that would actually allow me to work with them in exchange for food that I could actually use here at the Bed and Breakfast. I'm wondering if anybody, any of your guests would be able to kind of point us in that kind of a direction.
All right, Mia, thank you. We're almost out of time for this segment, but I want to go to Susan real quick. Did you want to respond to her question?
Legally, for someone to work on a farm, they need to be employed and making at least a minimum wage. So it's, you know, there's a lot of risks that farmers assume, and sometimes labor is involved in, you know, one of them. But that's the long and short answer to that question.
I want to take another Kathy from Woodbridge. Kathy, you're on Where We Live. If you could be quick before we go to break.
Yes, I just wanted to say that in Woodbridge, we were lucky enough to have some town land that wasn't being used, and it also had a house on it. We've now got a farm that's nonprofit and organic, and it's got a CSA membership of about 175 families. We also give away 10% of our food, and we employ a farmer on a salary full time. So I encourage people to look at their town open space and see if there's any opportunities to start small farms there, because if you're a nonprofit community farm, you're eligible for a lot of help from the U.S. and state governments in putting in fencing and irrigation and so on. So it's a very good model.
Well, thank you, Kathy, for your comment. We're going to go to break now, but when we come back, we're going to explore the debate over preserving farmland at a time when solar fields are growing to meet demand for renewable energy. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchel. Today we're talking about farming here in Connecticut, and I wanted to thank Susan Mitchell, owner and operator of Cloverleaf Farms in Mansfield, also Sven Peel, lead designer and owner of Connecticut Edible Ecosystems and the farm and grounds manager at Knox, for joining us this hour. Right now, joining us now is Greg Ladke, a Hartford Current reporter who covers the environment and agriculture, among other issues. Greg, welcome to Where We Live.
Thank you for having me.
I wanted to have you come on the show because as we're talking about the state of agriculture here in Connecticut, we're hearing that across the country, even in this state, there's a controversy brewing about ways to preserve farmland when we have solar energy demand also growing. Can you talk about a recent article that you wrote about how this is coming out here in Connecticut?
Yes. I was talking to a farmer in northeastern Connecticut about the drought that we've been having, and he said, well, that's not really my biggest problem. My biggest problem is I'm losing 100 acres of prime farmland to a solar field that's being put up in that part of the state. And when I started talking to other people, including the agricultural commissioner, Stephen Ravitsky, he said that loss of prime farmland to solar and other energy projects is his biggest concern. The state is spending millions of dollars every year to preserve prime farmland in Connecticut, and at the same time, indirectly giving incentives for solar fields to get renewable energy. So it's one of these very difficult situations where you have two very good goals and just and a difficult situation because farmers don't want to be restricted on what they can do with their land. And very often for some farmers, selling or renting part of their property for a solar field is a way to keep farming on the rest of their property.
And Henry Talmadge is here from the Connecticut Farm Bureau. Talk to us about what you're hearing about this tension here in the state.
Yeah, so this is Greg's story was a good one and kind of highlighted the fact that this is a complex issue. It's complex not only between agriculture and solar, but there's also kind of a complex discussion within agriculture about this because, as Greg points out, and that particular farmer losing access to land that he normally rents from to farm corn on to support his dairy operation, there are farmers who also would like to put solar on their farms in order to utilize a law that was passed a couple of years ago, which allows for virtual net metering on farms to offset their energy costs. So it's a very complex issue because it depends on not only the farms, and it's an opportunity to augment and offset some of their costs by installing solar on their farms, but it also comes to a land use issue and those who own the land versus those who rent the land. So even within agriculture, this debate is going on, and our policy development process as an organization is we're working through that right now, as a matter of fact.
So you don't want to see any type of law that would limit how farmers can use the farmland, but at the same time, there are issues whether these solar companies should be coming on to be using the farmland for their use.
Well, so one of the discussions that is going on about this is there a distinction between allowing solar on farms, again, to augment their farming operation to offset some of their costs, as opposed to a solar project that replaces an existing farm.
And there's also a big debate within the state government between agencies in terms of where should they be encouraging these energy projects to go. And it's not just solar now. It's also natural gas projects. And there's a big it'd be ideal to have these big solar projects on things like brownfields, old industrial sites. The problem being it's a lot cheaper to put it on a solar field or an energy project on wide open, generally level fields, which is a description of prime agricultural land. So you have the debate going on within the agricultural community. You have the debate going on within different state agencies, about three different ones. And we have I think we're going to see legislators talking about it in this coming session.
And is there a concern that, okay, so say a solar company is using this farmland for a certain amount of years until, I guess, the solar panels are no longer usable. Is there a concern that that will never go back to farming?
I think there is. State agricultural officials say it's highly unlikely in their view that once you take farmland out of production, that it will ever go back. It's hard to imagine that if a solar panel comes to an end of its useful life in 25 years, they're just not going to replace it.
Henry, did you want to add?
Yeah, I think even that issue is somewhat different than obviously if you create a subdivision and build houses, that land would never be available for agriculture again. There's some debate about this issue in terms of how the land, the underlying land resources, which are the soils and whether they're disturbed or not, whether or not they would be permanently impacted or not. I think it depends a lot on what techniques are used. But no question that during that interim period when the product – when the land is used for solar, it's not producing any agricultural products. And one of the things we're trying desperately to do is to grow agriculture in the state. So when the best land is removed from agriculture, it's a bad outcome, even if it's not permanent and as in terms of what it might be some days 40 years down the road.
I want to turn back to Greg Ladke, a reporter for the Hartford Current. Before we run out of time, how are other states dealing with this debate, Greg?
I think that it's starting to go very much in the same scenario of what do we do and how do we deal with it. Our agricultural commissioner said that told me that this is a problem throughout New England and the Northeast where there's not that much agricultural land left. And there's a really big push for solar and natural gas projects. So I think we're at the crunch point here in the Northeast just because we don't have that much land left.
But in other states where they have much more farmland and they see the price of crops going down, this is a lucrative way to keep that that land in with their family. Is that right, Henry?
Well, again, that goes back to kind of Greg's first point, and that is, you know, this there's no question that solar projects will be enter into the economic reality of certain farming family and farming operations. So in my mind, there is an opportunity to keep farms in business because of utilizing solar. The challenge is how do you do it in a scale that makes sense for everybody?
We'll have to leave it there. Henry Talmadge, Executive Director of the Connecticut Farm Bureau. Also good to see Greg Ladke, a reporter for the Hartford Current who covers the environment and agriculture, among other topics. Thank you so much for coming on today.
Thank you.
Our show is produced by Lydia Brown and Jeff Tyson. Our executive producer is Katie Tolarski. Continue the conversation on our website, wmpr.org/where we live. And thanks to technical producer Kion Wolf.